I'm going to pose the question, can Lorentz symmetry be emergent? I was about to say, no, the true question is I don't know, but the answer might be no. So what do I mean by emergent? I mean in the sense that, for instance, rotation symmetry might be emergent for a condensed matter system. So say even a gas or something, not even very condensed, or a liquid or a crystal that might even have preferred crystalline axes, but still certain phenomena, like let's say the sound in the crystal, has an isotropic spectrum. So that's what I mean by emergent. Could it be that the underlying space-time does not have Lorentz symmetry, but and therefore that the Lorentz symmetry that we've identified is approximate, not fundamental, and not something that has to be built into quantum gravity, let's say, or quantum space-time, which also brings up why I'm interested in it, the question, because if we could answer, let's say, no, it can't be emergent, it has to be fundamental, that focuses our attention on where we should or shouldn't be looking in addressing questions about quantum space-time and quantum gravity. So this will be just kind of a discussion. I'll raise issues and questions and provide few or no answers, but just try to set a basis for discussion. So what is Lorentz symmetry, first of all? So it's the invariance group of Minkowski metric. Let's just write that in d dimensions of space-time. It's SO d minus 1, 1. And it includes rotations in the spatial part and boosts, which are transformations to a moving frame in the rest of it. So it contains rotations and boosts. The case d equals 4 is kind of special because this group then corresponds to, actually as a 2-to-1 mapping, SL2C, which is a kind of very nice group. And even that, we can say, corresponds to a very beautiful thing, which is holomorphic maps of the Riemann sphere to itself. So say conformal group of Riemann sphere. And you know, I just point this out because you look at a Minkowski metric and you think about this group structure, and this doesn't pop into mind if you didn't already know about this connection, and there's something that seems very deep and beautiful and unique or something about this which wouldn't happen in an arbitrary dimension. So it could be that the answer to this question, or the answer to the question about the Lorentz symmetry we have apparently in our world, is related to d equals 4-ness and not just to Minkowski-ness, but I don't know. Okay, a key thing about this group is that it's non-compact. And I'm referring to the fact that you can boost to with a given boost factor in some direction, and that's a group element, and then you can just repeat that and repeat it any number of times, and keep going in the group. The picture to have in mind, I guess, is just a slice of the light cone. This would be Minkowski space, and a hyperbola is points at a fixed proper time from the vertex. And let's say if I were to boost that time-like vector a certain amount, I might get that. And I could boost it again by the same amount and go over here. And I could keep going, and even though on the picture it looks like there isn't much room, there's an infinite amount of room on this hyperbola or hyperboloid. So that's a different kind of symmetry than most of the ones that we ever verify or test fully in physics. And that's one of the points I want to bring up that makes it different, potentially. So it has an infinite group volume. So physically, what is it? It's a invariance under a change of frame. Say invariance under change of, let's say, velocity. And but in terms of states, it takes a state of a certain form momentum of a particle to another one. Let me call it lambda, you know, mu nu, p mu. And so for every state labeled by a certain momentum, we get a state with a boosted momentum in particular. And so we have an infinite number of momentum states, and for a given observer, they have they can have arbitrarily high frequency and short wavelength. So we get a kind of infinite Hilbert space, infinite dimensional Hilbert space. That's really not what I mean, but I have an infinite density of states. Which really is what leads to UV divergences in quantum field theory. Because loop integrals, we do loops where we're basically integrating over degrees of freedom labeled by, you know, states that we think are in the Hilbert space because the Hilbert space is invariant under this Lorentz group. So we can get loops diverge. Okay, so Lorentz symmetry plays an essential role in physics. We discovered it first from electromagnetism, which just so happened to be our first glimpse into something that, at least as of today, still qualifies as a fairly fundamental theory. And then we used it to find our way to the Standard Model of Particle Physics and general relativity. So it's been incredibly fruitful as a guiding principle. Constrains possible Lagrangians you could write down, organizes renormalization in quantum field theory, and just seems basically indispensable, at least as physics has been practiced for the past century or so. On the other hand, I'm questioning it, so why question it? Part of it, yeah. I probably gave most parts. So one is this. We can deal with UV divergences, but it just doesn't seem like a theory that is going to be fundamental, let's say, will allow us to maybe understand quantum gravity, that we can tolerate this indefinitely, this situation of UV divergences. So that would be one reason, try to escape from this. Another is, you know, like I said at the beginning, even if the answer is no, then that guides us in this open-ended search for quantum space-time. So it's important to know if it's absolutely essential or if we should be looking elsewhere also. Also, this business about non-compactness, this is really a philosophical point, but to me it's very important. So, you know, we do experiments and we probe some neighborhood of our own rest frame in terms of the boosts of physical systems relative to us, or what energy states of particles we probe, or whatever. So I sort of think of it like this: there's some region of this hyperboloid that we can check that symmetry in. But out here, there's an infinite volume of the group that we're never going to probe. So, of course, it's possible that the nature of the group is so simple and beautiful that somehow all you have to do is probe a finite amount of it to know that it's really an exact symmetry all the way out there forever. But I don't know of other examples in physics where that's the case. It seems like it's from an empirical point of view, a strange extension. And maybe if there's a whole different way of thinking about the nature of Lorentz symmetry, that in this picture it sort of looks more, I don't know, compact. Maybe that explains it. Anyway, so empiricism. So one reason is the UV divergences. Another reason is quantum space-time. We want to constrain the possibilities, empiricism. And there's one more reason that I used to list, which I won't list now, which is the finiteness of black hole entropy. Basically got that from Raphael Sorkin. Just because I've been thinking more about that, and it seems conceivable to me that just taking into account gravitational interactions by itself would render black hole entropy finite without actually cutting off the degrees of freedom that exist in the theory. But I wouldn't defend that point right now. I'm just mentioning it. So since I mentioned it, just to be provocative, I'll put a question mark. Black hole entropy less than infinity, question mark. Okay, so those are some reasons to question it. Now I want to mention, how well do we know that the world is Lorentz invariant so far? So tests of Lorentz symmetry. There are lots of different ways to probe that. I'll just make a list. We have, a very straightforward one would be time of flight, like the neutrino experiment. Does anything go faster than light? Or have a limiting speed that's less than the speed of light? Or a speed that depends on its energy when it shouldn't? Birefringence of the vacuum. We get bounds from all these different things. Thresholds for particle reactions. Clock comparisons. This is like tests for couplings of things like the spin of nuclei or electrons to an external direction, which is the direction established by the motion of the preferred frame, of us relative to a preferred frame. And, there are other ones too, maximum speed. I don't, of course, mean to be exhaustive here, but I just really want to make a point of what's the extent to which we've actually tested Lorentz symmetry. So we can get leverage by looking at either very long distances, so time of flight across big parts of the universe, so that even tiny effects can build up over a long distance. We could notice them. An example of that would be this business about light and neutrinos arriving at roughly the same time from a supernova, when a slight difference in the velocity would, over such a long baseline, pile up into a significant difference in time of arrival. Clock comparisons, you've got a macroscopic number of particles which are probed coherently by, say, interaction of microwaves with the system, so you can kind of leverage the individual interactions, which might be tiny, into shifted resonant interaction with microwaves with a macroscopic number of things. With thresholds, it's a little bit curious. I wanted to mention that. For example, so in relativity, we have E squared equals P squared plus M squared. Now, I think I'll actually adorn this with speeds of light, because we want to talk about the possibility that they're different for different particles. So I'll put C sub I squared. So this would represent, I guess I should say M sub I, the possible dispersion relation between energy and momentum for a particle that effectively had a speed of light that was dependent on the type of particle. And we might also have something like a fourth power of momentum and then other terms. And you might ask, suppose this thing is set by the Planck scale, would we ever be able to see it? Or let's put it differently. Whatever M is, how big would P have to be before we could pick up that this term was there? I won't talk about this. You might say, well, this should be comparable to that. It's the value of the momentum where this becomes comparable to that. This has P squared, this has P to the fourth, so we would need P to be of order M. So P to the fourth is comparable to the P squared term when P is of order M. So if M were the Planck mass, as you might guess, if this were some kind of a quantum gravity effect, then you know, you'd have to have particles with Planck energy, and we don't have any access to that. But that turns out not to be the right comparison, because certain phenomena, namely thresholds for particle reactions, are governed more by this term. It's crucial what masses are, whether certain reactions can proceed or not, say whether a particle is unstable or can emit Cherenkov radiation or can annihilate. So we should really be comparing this with that. And so you see that P to the fourth over m squared is of order m squared, little m squared, I'll put it that way, put all the c's to one now, when P is of order the geometric mean of this scale m and the particle mass. So if, for example, little m were, say, a pion mass, 10 to the 2 MeV, and let's say capital M is the Planck mass, which is 10 to the 22 MeV, to the 19 GeV, 22 MeV. So then I just chose that, so I have 10 to the 24 square root 10 to the 12. So this gives us 10 to the 12 MeV, or 10 to the 18 electron volts. So that's a very high energy, but it actually is lower than the highest energy cosmic rays that we have. Ultra-high energy cosmic rays go up to 10 to the 20 electron volts. So actually, this is why you can use observations of ultra-high energy cosmic rays, and in particular of the consequences of the GZK cutoff, which comes from these cosmic rays colliding with microwave background photons and making pions, why you can use that to actually get a handle on this term. And you would really, you could actually potentially put a bound on this coefficient here at order one part in 100 or something like that, which is quite amazing. So we're basically getting there, I think, more data and understanding of the recent, of the results from, what's that detector called in Argentina? Auger detector, yeah. Once, in a few years, we'll have, I think, a part in 100 bounds that are convincing on that coefficient. And so what boost does that correspond to? Well, if the mass is 10 to the 2 and P is 10 to the 12, that's a gamma factor of 10 to the 10. So this corresponds to a gamma of 10 to the 10 tested. Okay, so what that does for us is pushes out this region in the group a little farther, but there's still an infinite amount. So this is 10 to the 10 boost out there that we haven't tested. But it does mean that we're not going to easily see violations of relativity. Okay, so what it tells us is that if there is a Lorentz violation, it must be contained. So LV must be contained at this level. Okay. No. But let's discuss it later. Okay, maybe I should just say where I'm headed for the rest of my remarks. I want to now just say a little bit about how would we formulate a Lorentz violating theory given what we know, difficulties with emergent Lorentz invariants, and possible ways to evade those.
You never said anything about the fire fringes in the vacuum.
Right. I just don't have time to go over everything. Okay, so how to formulate LV theories. How to formulate Lorentz violating theory. So we could take the point of view that we just start with what we have. So start with the space-time metric and add something. So add Lorentz violating vector or tensor fields. So add vector or tensor fields. Background. So the one that I liked a lot was just adding a unit time-like vector. This is the ether. Unit time-like vector. It just defines some preferred frame at each point of space-time. Or we could start with less or different structure. As another possibility, start with less structure. And a nice thing to think about there is, how does it work in condensed matter, where we do have examples of emergence of Lorentz invariants for some degrees of freedom, at least. So condensed matter, you could say this is just a special case of relativistic quantum field theory, where you have GAB, and then you have some stuff, and the stuff defines more structure. Or you could say, I don't need to know relativistic quantum field theory to do condensed matter physics. What I have is Galilean spacetime. So I have, in that case, in the Galilean approach, I just have a time function. That's my cosmic time. And that layers spacetime into spatial slices. And on each of those, I have a spatial metric. Spatial geometry. And that's still not enough. I need to know, I have to take time derivatives. If something is to calculate a velocity of something moving, I have to know how far it went, divide by the time. But that means I have to compare a distance from a point on this time slice to one on this time slice, which I haven't got yet. So I can do that by either having some absolute rest frame and then measuring the distance to that, or I can introduce an inertial structure that's a little bit less information and just defines a family of inertial frames. So, but what we need is an inertial structure to do that. So let's just say inertial structure or an absolute rest frame. As an aside, I just want to mention, it's an interesting question then. The Galilean group here is also infinite. It's also non-compact. We have boosts to arbitrarily rapid moving velocities. And it's interesting to ask whether the Galilean group could be emergent, and if that question has a different answer from the Lorentzian question. So I don't know about that. We could have a different talk on, can Galilean symmetry be emergent? Whoa. Okay. So thank you. In Horava-Lifshitz gravity, it's interesting that we give up this inertial structure, but we add some more fields, which are lapse and shift fields, and we basically make the inertial structure part of the dynamics. And in a way, we get back to a metric and a function of time. Okay, so what are the problems? The problem here is that given this time and this metric, we can make all kinds of, it's not surprising that in condensed matter physics, we get Lorentz and occasionally get Lorentz symmetry coming out, because we can form a metric, let's call it G sub I, AB, by taking the gradient of our time function and multiplying it by something, which might depend on the species I'm talking about, and then adding the spatial metric. So I can construct a space-time metric out of the information in this system. The problem is that these guys are not universal, so that we shouldn't be surprised that we see Lorentz symmetry emerging in all kinds of condensed matter systems for specific degrees of freedom. But we have no reason to think that they should all emerge with the same common universal metric. So that's a problem. And now I have 12 seconds left to say, how do we solve that problem? And I can almost do it by truncating to a list instead of explaining the list, but it's somewhat self-explanatory. So there are various ways. I think Bill said earlier, Bill Unruh, that it seemed impossible to, you have to arbitrarily fine-tune to account for how the emerging Lorentz symmetry would be universal. And a lot of thought has gone into that, and there are possible ways to avoid that. So ways to obtain universal low-energy Lorentz symmetry. And this will just be a list because I'm out of time. Possibly you could build in a discrete subgroup of SO31. You could have supersymmetry. This is a very interesting story. You could have RG flow that drives you to Lorentz invariant infrared fixed point. In fact, there's evidence that that does happen, but it's too slow. That is logarithmic unless we have strong interactions at some high energy, but that's possible that we could have those, like, say, how about gravity? Causal sets is an approach to quantum space-time in which we might be able to achieve universal Lorentz symmetry, and I even think there's in the spin foam approach, there's a case to be made that the building blocks in themselves don't break Lorentz symmetry, and that possibly the emergent space-time could naturally be Lorentz invariant. But the screen is red, so I'll just have to stop with that.
Okay, Rob? Yeah, for brevity, focusing just on this, Galilean approach. I mean, why would one want to take 19th century space-time ideas and then try to get 21st century? I mean, we could also kind of imagine that maybe phlogiston is what does heat, and somehow it cleverly, things work out so that we actually think it's carried by, energy of atoms or something. I mean, but what is one hoping to gain?
One's hoping, I guess, to regulate UV divergences and not...
The regulation is done by not having space-time not be dynamical. You wouldn't have...
Because of rushing so quickly, I think my logic of the discussion was lost. Here I was just trying to point out how it is that Lorentz invariance emerges from a condensed matter system and how it doesn't. Here, if I had better time, I would point out that we actually don't have a fixed structure. We make the inertial structure dynamical, and it's true that there's still a time function. But I would call it, I wouldn't call it 19th century. It's a 21st century time function.
Could you explain the point 3 on your laundry list, the RG flow explanation, please?
As far as I know, originated with Nielsen and various collaborators in the 80s, asking, what if I just take a Lorentz invariant quantum field theory, add a Lorentz violating operator, and look at the RG flow? Does it tend to go away at long wavelengths? And they found in various examples that it did. There's a running of the coupling. They were looking at dimension 4 operators, and they're running logarithmically. And of course, we need a faster running than that if you imagine some sort of order unity Lorentz violation at some Planck scale or whatever, a logarithmic running is not going to be enough to agree with the experiments that I alluded to. So various people have thought maybe, well, the problem is you need, that's all done in perturbation theory. So a recent paper, for instance, by John Donahue, and I'm sorry, but I don't remember the collaborator's name. Amber, thank you. Looked at, this is artificial, but saying, well, one way to get around that is to have a large number of fields that are coupled and just sort of artificially force the flow to be faster. An idea that I find a little more appealing just sort of physically is the idea that, you know, we know that everything couples to gravity and that gravity gets stronger and stronger at higher energies. So in the UV, there's going to be extremely strong gravitational interaction between everything at some scale, unless, you know, there might be a theory where that gravity cuts off before it gets strong, but let's say we're not in that kind of a theory. Then, you know, then it's just on physical grounds, you can see that having different fields sort of carry their, maintain their own sense of the light cone or is just absurd because they're dressed by each other, and so they all just have to share the same notion of where operators commute and where they don't, and that defines the light cone and metric. So it's a physically sensible concept, I think, that just by virtue of strong interactions, if strong enough, you could sort of force the various degrees of freedom of a theory to agree, basically, to come to terms with each other on what is the causal structure and therefore what is the metric. Concrete calculations that show it are, of course, hard because we can't do strong coupling. Maybe somebody can use strong weak coupling duality to try to do a calculation like that. But that's what I was referring to.
Last question for Ted before we open the discussion here.
I was wondering because Einstein-Issa theory is not a UV complete theory. So how do you see it, you know, fit into a full quantum gravity theory or UV complete theory? I mean there's this law of Haravalifshitz, right? Which is a possible extension, but it's only to a subgroup of your theory.
Right.
So do you see any other chance to how would it fit into the full quantum gravity
theory? I don't know. Yeah. I wasn't pushing it for that. My own work on that theory has been at the level of an effective low-energy phenomenology. I completely agree with what you said earlier, though, about you just mentioned the idea here of being that by adding higher spatial derivative terms, you might actually achieve a theory that is UV complete without adding other degrees of freedom.
No questions? There's one question there. I invite now questions also for the other speakers of the afternoon session.
In the case with the ether theory again, would there be any means of distinguishing the actual this actual vector from the cosmological time-like vector?
Yeah, I mean there would definitely be. Okay, you have to talk about a specific theory, but the one that I had in mind, the propagation speed of gravitational waves and ether waves is defined relative to this frame. And that speed could be, in principle, measured actually by for waves created by binary sources or something. And so, yeah, it would be a measurable thing in that scenario.
Could you say a little more about what's so unsettling about the non-compactness in the case of the Lorentz group? So, I mean, compared to, say, the non-compactness that you get just from time translation symmetry or, groups of gauge symmetries are typically going to be non-compact as well.
So it seems groups like, at which gauge symmetries are not compact?
Well, in Maxwell theory, I mean, the group of gauge symmetries isn't going to be a compact group, is it? So at each,
locally,
at each point,
yeah.
It's a... just a rotation, but altogether, I specify a function over all of space-time, right?
Yeah.
And that gives me a gauge transformation. The family of functions on space-time isn't going to be a compact thing.
Yeah, that's an interesting...
I mean, and just, I mean, but it's the simpler example of translations. I mean, why?
Yeah, well,
why isn't that already spooky?
Because the world isn't really translation invariant. I mean,
yeah.
You see, and same thing is what I would say about time translation. But this Lorentz symmetry is supposed to hold locally at each point, no matter how much I boost as I fly through this point. Locally, I have this infinite symmetry. And similarly, I'd say a kind of similar answer about gauge symmetry, that the local gauge symmetry is compact. It's the global part that's not.
It's not, well, I mean, it looks like any tiny neighborhood, I'm already going to end up with a non-compact family of.
Yeah, because it's a continuous function or differentiable.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. That's why. Oh, wait, let's see. So let's ask ourselves the question, to what extent have we tested gauge invariance of some theory? I don't know how to disentangle. It completely controls the nature of the space of states, and everything about testing a gauge theory has sort of built into it from the beginning. What are the gauge invariant observables? And so have I tested that by the fact of all those agreements? Have I tested the non-compact nature of that group? I don't know. I have to think about it. It's a good question.
Yeah, Ted, one reason you didn't give, which I thought you might give, for thinking that Lorentz symmetry is broken, is that the actual solution of the Einstein equations, to the extent that it is a solution of the Einstein equations that describes our universe, is far from Lorentz invariant. That is, there is a preferred frame cosmologically. That doesn't impress you.
Should it?
Well, it depends. I mean, you've just made reference to local Lorentz invariance, but local Lorentz invariance is a gauge symmetry, which as you know is a very different kind of object than a real physical global symmetry. And so for the same reason that you just said, well, translation invariance is not really a symmetry of nature. You could say that Lorentz invariance is not really a symmetry of nature as actually realized in the universe. Therefore, maybe it's not a symmetry of a fundamental theory. I'm trying to be on your side here.
Thanks.
Nice to be alone. He's alone there.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
It's true.
I mean, in some level, Lorentz symmetry is also a statement about the structure of the vacuum that is local and is not affected by the cosmological frame or anything else.
But it's a vacuum state that's never realized in nature.
No, I mean the local vacuum. Because this infinite number of short wavelength degrees of freedom are as perfect, those are localizable on an arbitrarily small scale. So it's a physical assumption that in this little region of space-time, I have all those degrees of freedom. That's really what bothers me. Maybe it shouldn't, but it's what bothers me.
If that drives you crazy, what's really... Because I share that instinct, but then, on the other hand, what's the best idea about what replaces the Lorentz invariant theories that we have, like general relativity?
Well, there's a list of possibilities. I mean, I certainly don't know the answer. What's the best one? I should say that if I had to bet, well, I don't even know what I'd bet on.
I have a question, in fact, about the RG flow. I thought the evidence was, on the contrary, that if you break, let's say, that if you break Lorentz invariance by R-dimensional operator, then using the loop structure, this breaking will feed back lower dimensional operator, order two, order three, and that rules out such insertions of operator. That's this argument by, that was put forward 4 or 5 years ago. So I guess the only way to avoid that might be SUSY, but otherwise RGflow shows that, it doesn't work out.
Well, but that's a perturbative argument, but it's true.
Yeah,
that
yeah,
the
but
RG
even
RG
at the perturbative level, at
you.
The perturbative level, it even goes the wrong way. That is,
right.
If you break at higher order the symmetry, it feeds back into lower order more violently, quadratically. You need some extra argument to protect that things from happening, and so a priori RG flow goes against this. It doesn't help.
Well, I think the strong interactions argument could also help with that. But you're right, perturbatively RG flow would not help with that.
I have a question about the first point, discrete subgroup, and its relation with non-compactness.
Yeah.
Because we know that in lattice gauge theory, you have this discrete group, the group of the lattice that protects SO4.
Right.
So what's going wrong here and why non-compactness?
Yeah, that was what I wanted to mention, actually. I didn't have time, so I'm glad you asked me. So, in Euclidean lattice theory, let's say, it's a square lattice. If you have this discrete rotation symmetry, that's enough to force the two-derivative term in the action to actually be invariant under full continuous rotational symmetry. And you might say, well, could I do the same thing on a Lorentzian lattice that has discrete but infinite subgroup of the Lorentz group as the symmetry? I don't see any reason you couldn't, but when it's not just the lattice that has to have this discrete symmetry, but also the action. So here, when you write down the couplings between values of fields and different points in the lattice, you have to respect this discrete rotation symmetry to be able to make that argument about the low-energy theory. The same thing would be true in the Lorentzian case, but since the group is non-compact, you'd have to couple each lattice point to an infinite number of other points in order for the lattice action to have that symmetry. And that sounds problematic, but actually I've never seen anybody look at it closely and see whether it's truly untenable completely or whether it could be implemented. It's probably sick because the dynamics will be too interconnected, but I'd like to see somebody try it.
And there's apart from discrete subgroup of Lorentz group, there's also this proposal of a continuous subgroup. It's Cohen-Glashow very special relativity.
Oh, yeah.
So you think this is a mechanism that could protect Lorentz?
Well, they had trouble coming up with any kind of a local action that would implement that idea, not to mention how to incorporate gravity into it. So. Maybe if you can overcome those two big obstacles, but I've never seen anything that starts to overcome them.
I have questions for the other speakers too, of the afternoon. Is there some?
My question is for Ted. You didn't add causal dynamical triangulations to this list or any discrete Ricci-like calculus model. So I was wondering why that is.
Well, CDTs seem to have a preferred frame, and I didn't see a mechanism to get rid of that. So that's probably why I didn't include those. And Ricci, I sort of view this as the best way I know of on the market to sort of approach Ricciization of quantum gravity path integral, but maybe there are other ways.
I have a question or a comment which may not fit with the theme of the workshop, but since I don't meet philosophers very often, I thought I will ask that question. We talk about idealized models and then limiting situations, as one of the speakers spoke. And as physicists, we feel very comfortable about it, and it relates to the real world, in spite of the fact that the coffee cup is finite. So I wonder, is it anything to do with the way that we are, our brain is wired? Because it turns out we are very imaginative. In our mind, we are able to think about Hilbert space, about infinity, and about unimaginable things we are able to imagine. So is it the reason we feel very comfortable in the way that we do science now, in terms of idealized models and in terms of limits? So it's a very general question. No. Is it to do with, suppose you had a very powerful computer, it is possible that it may not be very comfortable with continuum or infinities. So that's my question or comment.
So I don't know. So one kind of thing you might think is critical phenomena, there's this explanatory agenda. Why do all these different substances have the same critical exponents? And renormalization group techniques seem like a good way to give a uniform answer to that question. I'm trying to make a connection to sort of cognitive limitations or cognitive capacities peculiar to us as a species. It might be, as a matter of fact, the reason all these different substances have the same critical behavior there is no uniform reason. It's just that there's some truly fundamental, super complicated, beyond our computational capacity theories of each of the individual substances. And this collection of theories happens to deliver the same set of critical exponents. And so the connection I'm trying to make to your question is, it might be because of the kind of creatures we are, if we are not up to the piecemeal theory model by model computation that just happens to deliver the same answer to this collection of questions, we're more moved by this attainable technique that gives an answer wholesale to the whole set of questions. And we sort of ex post facto celebrate the explanatory gain of getting one answer to a whole set of questions over a bunch of piecemeal answers that just happen to dovetail without any further available explanation of that. That's the one thing I can think of to say. But Bill is.
I think there's a danger in asking that we limit ourselves to our current history. If we go back and look before, Newton and Leibniz, et cetera, invented calculus and all of the ideas of limits, et cetera, people were incredibly uncomfortable with these concepts of the what we would call a continuum, which we're perfectly happy with. And so something that we find unimaginable now could very well be the stuff that you teach to grade oneers in 200 years' time. So I think it's always very dangerous to sort of talk about these limitations of the human imagination.
I'm not at all happy with the notion of continuum as a model of physics or mathematics. That's
Yeah, I wanted to just comment on whether causal sets belongs on that list, or maybe I don't want to erase it entirely, of course, but maybe it should be on its own list, because that list, if I understand, are things which break Lorentz symmetry in some way, but at low energy it returns. Whereas in the case of causal sets, there's a certain sense in which it has an exact Lorentz symmetry at any energy. And you might ask, there's a theorem I could quote that explains exactly rigorously what I mean by that, which is that a Poisson sprinkling of Minkowski space cannot pick out any distinguished direction. That's a theorem that one can prove.
Yeah, but a Poisson sprinkling is presumably not what will describe our world if our world is described by a causal set.
No, it won't be exact, of course, but that would be the thing that would correspond to a perfectly flat Minkowski space-time, which, as was pointed out before, is not what we really live in, of course. But anyway, there's a sense in which it doesn't break Lorentz invariance at all. And so you might ask, how is that consistent with not having an infinite number of local degrees of freedom, which is your worry, I think. And the answer is that somehow they get pushed off to infinity. So there's a kind of maximum boost that you could have just based on an infrared cutoff, just from the fact that our space-time is of a certain size, even if it were, say, exactly flat, which it's not, there'd be a certain maximum gamma factor that would make any sense. Basically, what happens is, if you imagine a little ball-like neighborhood, it gets stretched out into an ellipse, and at some point, it would just run off the edge. So that's a very large gamma factor. It's about 10 to the 60, okay? But beyond that, you would not be compatible with the visible universe.
Can I respond by a question?
Yeah.
I've been wondering, so let's step away from the Poisson sprinkling that gives Minkowski space and consider a curved space-time, but described by a causal set. So the curvature introduces some length scale, sort of more locally. You know, at what level does that curvature get sensed in the approximate local Lorentz symmetry of the causal set in local experiments?
Yeah, I think it's given, it's set, I think as you would expect, it's set typically by the radius of curvature. But
at a boost, what boost factor? How do I?
The ratio.
What's the ratio to think about?
The ratio of the radius of curvature to the Planck length.
To the Planck length.
But there can be special cases where you can boost in certain directions much farther without seeing it. Sort of the null, principal null directions of the Weyl tensor. But
mm-hmm. So it's still very far off. We wouldn't expect to see any Lorentz violation ever.
Yeah, I think that, unfortunately, yeah.
I have a question for Shankar. You were talking today about a system where, you know, the wave function in the bulk and the correlation function on the boundary and the space-time are identical. But can you imagine that, in fact, it's part of a more general correspondence where, you know, there's a correspondence between wave functions and correlation function, but the mapping might not be just the identity, but might be a fixed, map designed by the system?
Yeah. You could certainly take any problem for which you have a path integral and rotate it, doesn't have to be Lorentz invariant. You'll get something when you rotate anything. And if you slice it the new direction, you will get some kind of theory. And I don't know what the theory will be. I don't know if it'll correspond to anything we know. But it will, in fact, give the expectation values of some products of field operators the new problem. But it could be a different problem. The thing about this problem was it's like self-dual. It's the same function that comes on the edge as on the bulk. You may find problems where there's a relation between what happens in the edge and what happens in the bulk, between two very different theories.
I think his question was, is there a transformation which could connect for a given problem?
Look, I've told you everything I know, and if you ask me no questions, I will tell you no lies. This is all I know. If you take this problem, you rotate by 90 degrees, you got another problem which I can recognize just by looking at it. And in the rotation, the ordinary fermion has become the Majorana fermion, and the points retain the labels. And ZFJ, which is the generator of wave functions, became the generator of correlation functions. It's kind of tailor-made for this problem. Fortunately, there's more than one example. You have examples in 2 and 3, or 1D, 2D, 3D. You can make these examples, as long as you have a linear Hamiltonian, linear in the coordinates. Yeah.
If the system is one in which you don't have a change in the effect of a Hamiltonian at the boundaries, then I would go along with what you're saying. But, of course, in general, that's not true. you can have a situation where the effect of Hamiltonian changes. In fact, that's the usual situation. And under those circumstances, I don't think you could make that assertion.
You will relate, look, the rotated object also depends on, suppose you pick endpoints, okay? You got some function here. After you turn it, those endpoints mean something else. But numerically, it's the same number, but it stands for something else. It's just that the something else here happens to be the correlation function of the edge theory of the very same bulk theory I began with.
Yeah, that's my point. It's the same theory.
Yeah, I'm saying if you rotate it in a general problem, you will get a new, you'll get the same action, but time and space will be exchanged, right? Why are you upset?
Take an ordinary solid. We know that near the surface of the solid, the effect of Hamiltonian is changing, right?
Yeah, yeah, I understand. But here the change is that there is a sudden change in chemical potential in the solid.
Oh, it's more, but it's more than just a change in chemical potential.
In this problem, it's
only... problem, but that's my point. You're assuming that there, that's
Look,
the
first
only
of all,
change.
In this problem, I was able to extract the wave function by a certain trick. The trick was to find a way to go from your system to the Fock state by doing something.
Yeah.
Because you got to project onto the Fock space, Fock state. That was done by changing mu drastically to a very low negative value. You can do that only in a problem where particle number is not conserved. Because in this problem, even though mu started out as a chemical potential electrons, it became a mass term for the Dirac fermions, and they can be confined only with a mass term. And they like to live where the mass is zeros. That's why those Jaki-Ribby modes were at the edge of this problem. In any other problem, you'll have to tell me what your original Hamiltonian is. Then we have to write down a partition function. You've got to see if you can write the wave function again as a partition function. It's not always true. If you give me a problem with only n fixed number of particles, what partition function do you want me to even think about, right? N is fixed number. So the only generalization we can think of is to superfluid superconductors in 1, 2, and 3 dimensions, but not to other interesting systems, which do have stuff at the edge, which is gapless and somehow connected to the bulk, but not in any explicit way.
Right, okay, we agree, yeah.
I got one short question. Go ahead. Is there someone? I think so. Okay, someone else is. I just wanted to correct something that I said in an answer to Ted's question, which is how large a boost would you need in order to see the failure of local Lorentz invariance in a curved space? So I think I said it was the ratio of the Planck length to the radius of curvature, but I think the right answer depends on what region of space-time you're trying to see the Lorentz invariance over. It's really the ratio of the diameter of that to the curvature. So if you wanted to see it over, say, 1 centimeter, then it would be the ratio you need. So then you might, I don't know if that brings it within reach. It's still going to be a very large number. In particular, the one I was talking about, the ultraviolet, the infrared cutoff, that's going to bring it down from 10 to the 60 to 10 to the 30. It's still a ridiculously large number. But maybe in some high region of curvature, it could become more significant. The other thing was I wanted to comment on I agree with everything you said about the discrete subgroup. I think he probably had in mind that people know that there are discrete sub... If you take an integer lattice, is that what you had in mind? If you take an integer lattice in Minkowski space, then there's an infinite discrete subgroup of the Lorentz group that leaves that invariant.
Yeah.
And then you pointed out that to make the action invariant is problematic in that situation. But if we don't worry about that, we could ask, are there effective low energy terms in an effective field theory that would see some of this breaking? This is what you get in lattice gauge theories or something when you're dealing with rotational invariance. There are some effective terms that you could add to the action that would be invariant under the subgroup but not invariant under the full rotation group. And then you can argue whether they tend to go away, be irrelevant terms and go away in the infrared. The interesting thing seems to be that there are no such terms, no such local terms at all in the case of the Lorentz group.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you publish that?
No. Yeah, I won't try to answer, but I think it. It was a comment that I was making. I just thought it might be interesting in the context of some of these discussions.
Okay. I have a question to Shankar. Is this emergent Lorentz symmetry, does it survive for excited states? In particular, suppose I start with the PIP superconductor with one vertex, what happens to the?
Oh, yeah, I think Nigel, whereas he asked me the same question. In fact, he wanted to know not just one vertex, but an array of vortices. You can turn that on the side and you will get, in a space-time, some instanton-like objects. It'll give you the correlation in the presence of those things. That is correct.
Are they identical?
Yeah. Look, it's take a block of something with lines in it if you want and turn it, it will look like the same thing. But what used to be spatial vortices will now appear in space-time for the edge thing. I have a question for this audience.
But what if they're not vortices?
Yeah. Can I ask my question to the audience? Do we really have to talk till 5 o'clock or can we just go? Because I have no more answers, so I stop. So most discussions are only for 30 minutes, right? Why are you grilling us for 1 hour? I want to know that.
Is that a question?
Yeah. What about quantum? Talking about vortices, you can see that.
Microphone.
Oh, quasi-particle. Look.
Sorry.
Look, any other question you ask, I am as prepared to answer it as you are, in the sense that I know what happens if you take the particular state, one ground state, and do this. If you take a ground state in a sector with some winding number, I think I can imagine doing that. Once you take quasi-particles, you got to find the way. Yeah, yep, I think it'll work. If you create an initial state from minus infinity with a particle in it, rather than just the BCS ground state, you can do all of this to that also. That's correct. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I know what the problem is. No. It works because if you evolve a system for a very long time in imaginary time, usually project the ground state. Mm-hmm. If you have some way of starting an initial state, which after long time evolution will reduce to a state with one quasi-particle in it, then you can use that as your seed in the right side of your partition function. Then it'll give you the correlation function in the presence of that entity. But I don't know what it means after rotation. Right? I don't know what it means when you rotate it. What looks like a quasi-particle when you slice it one way, I don't know what that state is when you rotate it. I mean, I'll have to think about that.
So we're breaking the 30 minutes barrier.
For Ted, what's the relationship between the T and the Galilean approach to the presumably fundamental condensed matter theory and the T in the metric of GR once you recover Lorentz invariants? Is the first T a kind of background time that gets washed out by the time you get down to low energy, or?
You're asking if you start with the preferred time function, how can it disappear, basically,
right?
Not be preferred, yeah. So in the Galilean description, it doesn't disappear. It's just that's part of physics. I guess in the Harava gravity, it's kind of a more, I think, interesting question. But even there, I think it doesn't disappear. You can see the effects of that preferred time function, or at least of its of the surfaces that it defines. Maybe not actually the value. The theory is invariant under reparameterizing its value, but. So yeah, you don't, unless you contrive somehow. Some recent work was done on trying to supersymmetrize ether theory and also looking at supersymmetrizing the Harava theory. And if that were the case, that it could be done, then given that there's evidence that supersymmetry can suppress low-energy Lorentz violation, maybe, yeah, the effects of that time function could be hidden at low energy. But that paper I'm talking about, which is by Puholis and Sibirikov, they failed to find a way to supersymmetrize, at least so far, the Harava theory. The ether, they only were supersymmetrizing the dynamics of the vector field on a fixed Minkowski background. That was just the initial step. But it looked like they said maybe you could extend it to the whole theory. If so, then maybe you could account for invisibility of the preferred frame at some level.
Would that also mean there is no spin zero mode?
No, I don't think so.
Since you didn't have time to answer it before, what about birefringence of the vacuum?
Well, some ways that you could imagine violating Lorentz symmetry do lead to different propagation speeds or even different coefficients of higher momentum terms in the dispersion relation for different polarizations, photons. So that would mean that you would get an initially linearly polarized signal would become depolarized. Where you get rotation, but the rotation could depend on the momentum of the component wave. So if it's composed of many momenta, it would become depolarized. Is that what you're asking?
I was simply asking what you meant.
Yeah, so I mean different propagation speeds for opposite helicity photons in the vacuum, possibly dependent on their momenta.
This, as we know very well, partly from your work, is a case where there are the largest bounds on M for a cubic term, which is what appears in effective field theory for Maxwell. And as you know very well, M is bounded by something like 10 to the 9, it has to be above something like 10 to the 9 Planck masses. Are you discouraged by that as somebody who has been thinking about Lorentz invariances not being fundamental?
Well, I mean, first of all, I'm basically happy. The stronger the bounds get, I'm happy, because I think that probably the most useful thing about the whole thing is just stimulating people to measure and put bounds on how, to what extent Lorentz symmetry could be violated. Also, however, it's easy to rule out the terms you're talking about by just assuming that whatever the Lorentz violation is, it doesn't violate CPT symmetry, in which case the
CP or CPT?
CPT. That would rule out the P cubed terms you're talking about if it preserves CPT. So, I mean, in other words, there's a natural or simple way to evade that bound and still have other Lorentz violation if you want.
It has been suggested that this is a good time to think about two things. One, that the sun is out, the second,
Yes.